This is Cedric Forster reporting to you from Boston. Carter Davidson of the Associated Press reports today that the bowstrings of Arab emotions in Palestine have become so taut that a single minute incident such as a marketplace insult could set the Holy Land aflame with war. This tenseness of nerves is due to the statement issued by the British American Committee investigating the Palestinian question, a report which recommended that 100,000 Jews be admitted to the disputed territory, but which denied to both Arab and Jew alike the privilege of setting up an autonomous state. In the past, when the words of a foreign correspondent have been quoted on this broadcast discussing the Palestinian question, mail has been stacked on my desk, assailing the integrity and the credibility of the correspondent. And I thought today that I'd give you briefly the background of Carter Davidson, Associated Press correspondent in Jerusalem. Carter Davidson was born 30 years ago on a farm near Huntsville, Alabama. And when a young lad, he moved to Marion, Indiana. And after his graduation from the University of Indiana, he worked on Indiana and Ohio newspapers. In 1943, he joined the staff of the Associated Press in its Cleveland bureau. He became state editor of the Associated Press in Columbus, Ohio in 1945, but shortly thereafter, he was sent overseas in the Foreign Service. Carter Davidson, who is an exceedingly serious and studious young man, is a specialist in what might be termed human relations. During his service with the Associated Press, he covered many labor disputes in various types of industry. And one of his outstanding contributions to news coverage was his work in the race riots in Detroit, Michigan. He is scrupulously fair, utterly fearless in objective reporting. And in his dispatch today, he makes the unequivocal statement, "The Arab masses are seething, both in the little towns and in the villages, as well as in the so-called native quarters in Jerusalem. Tension is at its highest point since the British White Paper put an end to the bloodshed in the year 1939. Davidson's story today is of unusual interest in that he has reported the high feelings and the antagonisms which give the impetus to the currents and the cross-currents of bitterness in Palestine. No accusation can be made against Carter Davidson that he's been subjected to British pressure or that his dispatch was suppressed by British censorship. Davidson said today that one Arab leader told him the British made a fatal mistake in the Palestinian report when they described the hostility in the Holy Land as differences between the Arabs and the Jews. What really exists is a three-cornered hostility with the British as a full partner. Another Arab leader told him this time the Arabs will not be as poorly financed as they were in their fight against suppression 7 and 10 years ago. There is only a thin margin between present public opinion among Arabs and the feelings which resulted in those uprisings. It will take only some minute incident to put the torch to a highly inflammable situation. Tens of thousands of Arabs in little towns and villages now are in possession of guns. They are the same guns which the Arabs of Syria kept close at hand when there were troubles in their land. Now that these troubles have been alleviated, rifles, revolvers, and machine guns have made their way back across the northern border of Palestine. And whatever actions the Arabs take en masse will be directed by responsible men whom the Arabs trust. And Arab leadership will not shirk its responsibility to the Arab world, nor will it dodge its responsibility for the actions of the Arab masses. Turning once more to the hatred which the Arabs bear for the British, one leader told Davidson, the British utterly erased 6 Arab villages during the uprisings a decade ago, and they literally wiped them from the face of the earth. It was the British in Palestine who gave to the National Socialists in Germany the pattern for Lidice. Davidson reports that there are many Arabs now tending flocks on hillsides or working in bazaars who participated in the violence of 7 years ago. And they refer bitterly to the reprisals by the military against their sorties. They leave the impression of fury for vengeance, which may add intensity to any strife which may come now. Highly placed Arabs freely predicted that Arab soldiers of the Transjordanian Arab League and of the Frontier Patrol, most of them fierce, fight-loving Bedouins, would rebel rather than move to suppress any Arab uprisings resulting from the inquiry committee's report. The British military, Davidson declared, expressed confidence in the loyalty of the Arab Legion. Nevertheless, Davidson reports that Arab leaders have told him that the days of the late 30s, when poorly armed but fighting mad Arab hordes swept out of the hills to wage war on what they called the Jewish invaders, those days were being recalled, and they were being replanned. It doesn't seem an exaggeration to report to you today, as one reads the news dispatches from the Middle East, that the Arab world, with its scores of millions of people, is more than stirring uneasily as a result of this Palestinian report. It is still a report, however, and it should be borne in mind that the inquiry committee had no power to do anything other than to recommend. And insofar as its recommendations are concerned, Prime Minister Clement Attlee made it quite plain that the British government does not intend to implement the report with action until the British learn the intentions of the American government. And the British feel that the Palestinian question is too dangerous for them to handle all alone. And they want to know just how far the United States will go in giving them moral, financial, and, if necessary, military support. There appears to be no inclination in Washington amongst congressional leaders to commit the United States to a settlement of the problem. Nevertheless, it should be pointed out in all honesty that the Palestinian quandary has all of the necessary elements of a world explosion. While there is no question that British interest in Palestine is linked with the maintenance of Britain's lifeline to the East, that it is bound up in her interests of empire, the fact still remains that the Arabs have ties with the entire Mohammedan world. And these ties already may be regarded as a smoldering fuse, one which is possessed at least of the potential of enkindling the common mass. And such a thought is indeed a specter. Thus, it's incumbent upon the United States and Great Britain to bend every effort toward a peaceable solution. In all of this controversy, the Russians have remained utterly aloof. Moscow quite probably views the Palestinian question as a problem for the capitalist world to solve. And if that world fails to solve it, then the ground will be broken, the spadework will have been done for the infusion of the Soviets' ideology into the fertile, rich, lush soil of the Middle East. In just a moment, I'll continue this broadcast. Now we have a word from your announcer.
Today at Axland O'Hare's men's shop, they have new Manhattan shorts. There are two types, the boxer style with all-around elastic waist and the side tie style with gripper fasteners. In stripes and solid colors, these fine quality shorts are priced at 75 cents, 85 cents, $1.10, and $1.50. See them this afternoon at Axland O'Hare's men's shop in the Elks Building in Aberdeen.
Here at home in the United States, the wires incessantly type out news of the greatest import, and that news runs the gamut from labor disputes, the British loan, extension of the draft law, to the flaming battle which still continues on Alcatraz Island, to the running of tomorrow's Kentucky Derby. The coal strikers under the iron and dictatorial hand of John L. Lewis threaten to paralyze the industry of America. Already a creeping sickness is spreading like a pall over the nation to strangle production. Faced with the emergency of ever-dwindling supplies of coal, the Office of Defense Transportation announced today a 50% reduction in passenger rail service by coal-burning locomotives, effective the 15th of May, a week from Wednesday. In the meanwhile, it should be said that the rails themselves may not be operating too long after that date. The rail unions today told the operators that they must grant their employees an increase of $1.20 a day, over and above the increase of $1.28 a day recommended by an arbitration commission last month. If they don't meet these demands, then the union says the alternative is a strike vote and a strike throughout the nation. This possible future catastrophe in no way transcends the importance of the present workout in the coal mines. Almost 420,000 miners in 25 states have been absent from the coal pits for 33 days. From all over the nation come dire predictions of what is going to happen if the strike isn't settled within a matter of days. From all over the nation come reports of what has actually happened, of reconversion plans being upset, of production actually stifled in the vice-like grip of John L. Lewis's hands. The octopus-like tentacles of that strike are reaching out into all phases of the economic life of this country. Plants are closing, workers are being laid off, with a consequent sharp reduction in consumer buying power through the non-payment of wages. And all of this because there is not sufficient coal to service the nation. The issue is clear, although there are conflicting opinions as to whom are right. John L. Lewis demands an annual sum of $60 million. It is to be paid by levying an assessment on each ton of coal which is mined, and it's to be paid to the Treasury of the Union. Lewis says that this fund is to be used for the general improvement of working conditions for the miners along the lines of health and safety. The operators are adamant in their refusal to yield to such a demand. The operators declare that they have no real assurance as to how that money is going to be used, and they are against the matter in principle in any event. The operators further declare that the miners have consistently refused to accept improved safety and health conditions, and they view Lewis's demands as an attempt to set up a fund which Lewis could use as he saw fit. The acceptance of Lewis's demands, insofar as Lewis is concerned, is the prerequisite to any discussion of wage increases. John L. Lewis won't even talk about the question of wage increases until he gets his $60 million. This is Cedric Foster reporting to you from Boston. I'll be back with you Sunday over many of these stations at 6:30 and again next week, Monday through Friday at the same time.